When the war broke out in Israel, we heard about safe rooms where families went to take refuge from the missile attacks. But what are those safe rooms really like? How big are they? What do they come equipped with? This week on The Land and the Book, we're heading for Israel, where we'll go inside a safe room. You'll feel like you're right there with us. Plus, we'll look at a great assortment of your Bible questions, and we'll end it all with a fishy tax story. Welcome to The Land and the Book with Middle East expert Dr. Charlie Dyer. I'm John Gager. How's your day going, Charlie?
John, it's going great. Thank you.
Well, I'm thinking that Passover will soon be upon us, Charlie, and one of the traditional Passover questions is, what makes this night different from all others? Passover, of course, is an important biblical holiday that has great meaning for both Jewish people and believers in Jesus. So this is a great question to ask, I would think.
It is, John. And if people want to learn what makes Passover so special, well, our friends at Life and Messiah are offering to mail them a free copy of their Messianic Passover Haggadah. The booklet will lead you through the celebration of Passover to see the rich connections to Jesus, our Messiah, and the Last Supper. You'll also receive a link for an interactive Passover Seder video. With the Haggadah and video, you can celebrate Passover this year with your family and friends. Now, to get this free offer, just go to lifeinmessiah.org and click on the Moody Radio button there to find out more and to request your copy. That's lifeinmessiah.org.
All right, let's take a look at current events. And as we do so, we want to remind you that our Moody Radio one-hour special, Inside Israel, is available for download at moodyradio.org/specials. We'll tell you more about that at the conclusion of our current events segment. Charlie, the month of Ramadan ended without major incident, but the war between Israel and Hamas continues to take a series of unexpected twists and turns. So what are the latest developments?
Yeah, you know, everyone was concerned about an explosion of violence during Ramadan. Both Hamas and ISIS had called on Muslims to march on Al-Aqsa and to target non-Muslims. But the final Friday of Ramadan was peaceful, with 120,000 people praying at the site. And the month then quietly ended this past Tuesday. In terms of the war with Hamas, Israel announced last Sunday it had concluded the active invasion stage of the war and had withdrawn its forces from Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. The IDF chief said the withdrawal doesn't mean the war's ended, but it's simply designed to help the army prepare for the incursion into Rafah. However, that might not be the full story. There could be several reasons for the announced withdrawal. The first might be Israel's response to the warning from President Biden that Washington would change its policy of supporting Israel in its war unless Israel implemented major changes. These included specific steps to address the humanitarian situation there in Gaza and more flexibility in reaching a ceasefire. Former Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi joined dozens of congressional Democrats calling on the president to halt weapons transfers to Israel. The second reason for the announcement could be a concession to Hamas for reaching a deal on the hostages. It's less than Hamas is demanding, but it provides a possible way to move the negotiations forward. There's also a third possible reason Israel announced the pullout, and it gives Israel an opportunity to rest its forces and repair its equipment for either an incursion into Rafah, as they've announced, or for war against Hezbollah in the north. Prime Minister Netanyahu said Israel has a date on the calendar for the Rafah invasion, and they're purchasing tents to evacuate civilians from the area around any ground offensive there. At the same time, Israel is preparing their forces to meet challenges from Hezbollah and Iran in Lebanon. The warning that the U.S. could withhold weapons and ammunition, especially in the face of Iranian threats, is a warning Israel takes seriously, especially since it's being voiced in other Western countries. In fact, in the U.K., former British Prime Minister Boris Johnson called the threats being made there an example of the death wish of Western civilization. And sadly, his analysis appears to be right on the mark.
Well, Charlie, you mentioned the impending threat from Hezbollah and Iran a moment ago. What is behind that current threat? How serious is it?
Well, we know Iran has been behind much of the current tension in the Middle East. They've helped supply weapons and training to Hamas, even though Hamas are Sunni Muslims while Iran is Shiite. But Iran's also supplied arms, including missiles and drones, to Hezbollah in Lebanon and to the Houthis in Yemen, who share Iran's Shiite brand of Islam. These two take orders from Iran. The current threat level escalated when Israel launched an airstrike in Damascus that killed a top Iranian general who sat on Hezbollah's decision-making body. This was a major blow to Iran and to Hezbollah. Iran has vowed to retaliate, and it's almost certain they will. The only question is how. One possibility is to respond in a similar fashion, trying to attack an Israeli embassy or diplomatic site somewhere in the world. And they've done that before. Back in 1992, Iran set off a car bomb that destroyed the Israeli embassy in Argentina. Now, the other possibility is that Iran might try a direct attack on Israel itself. You know, their proxies in Yemen, Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq have launched drones and missiles here in the recent past. Some believe Iran might try to launch a swarm of drones or cruise missiles against Israel. Israel has the ability to intercept drones and missiles, though if enough are launched, some might make it through. But that would also allow Israel to unleash its arsenal against Iran, and Israel could do far more damage. They could stop many, perhaps most, of Iran's missiles and drones. But Iran doesn't have the ability to stop an Israeli counterattack. Israel could attack Iran's nuclear facilities, as well as Iran's allies in Lebanon and Syria and Yemen. Iran's threat is real, but they're likely weighing the cost to their own country should Israel respond.
You're listening to a conversation with Dr. Charlie Dyer, noted Old Testament scholar, Middle East expert, and yours truly, John Gager, a look at current events here on Moody Radio's The Land and the Book. Turkey and Iran continue to struggle financially. How much of an impact did Turkey's finances have on their recent elections, and what's happening financially in Iran?
Well, finances did have a significant impact on Turkey's elections. President Erdogan's party suffered a major defeat in those municipal elections. He campaigned hard for his candidate in Istanbul to defeat the incumbent mayor from the opposition party, but the incumbent mayor won easily. Erdogan's party also lost in other major cities like Ankara and Izmir. The dominant issue for voters were Erdogan's financial policies and their negative impact on Turkey's economy. Now, switching from Turkey to Iran, they've also experienced a sharp crash in the value of their currency. In fact, over the last week or so, the currency dropped 30% in just one day. Inflation in Iran is out of control. One example people gave, 50,000 Iranian rials would have bought 30 eggs a decade ago. Now it buys a single egg. There have been demonstrations across Iran because of the economic hardships. But the difference between Turkey and Iran is this. Turkey at least has free elections with different political parties. In Iran, the Ayatollahs approve who gets to be on the ballot. Iran is in economic decline as a result, yet they continue spending to expand their military, advance their nuclear program, and threaten Israel, all at the expense of the average Iranian just trying to make ends meet.
Wow, doesn't sound good. Archaeologists believe they have uncovered religious details of the ancient Philistines. What exactly have they discovered, Charlie?
You know, John, this is a fascinating study. Archaeologists excavating the biblical city of Gath analyzed the remains of plants and seeds found in a temple there, and they discovered the priests used psychoactive plants in their ceremonies. Now, these aren't psychedelic drugs, but rather drugs that cause changes in, you know, mood, awareness, feeling, or behavior. Now, think of drugs like caffeine, nicotine, or alcohol, rather than drugs like LSD. They were mood enhancers that they were using, but even more significantly, these drugs help connect the religious practices of the Philistines to rituals and myths associated with the ancient Greek gods and goddesses, like Hera, the goddess of marriage and childbirth, and Artemis, the goddess of hunting, and Demeter, the goddess of agriculture and grain, and Asclepius, the god of medicine. The study points to a close relationship between the ritual practices of the Philistines and those practiced in the Aegean Islands. Now, these details help confirm what the Bible makes clear in Amos chapter 9 and Jeremiah 47. There, God connects the origin of the Philistines to the region of Kaphtor, which is the biblical name for Crete. These additional archaeological details about the Philistines' religious practices just help authenticate their connection and their origin in the Aegean region.
And that's a look at current events. Charlie, we are just back a few weeks from our tour of Israel. We traveled 1,100 miles, spent 5.5 days in the country, but we interviewed more than 30 people, bringing back more than 12 hours of conversations, all for this 54-minute special called Inside Israel. A highlight moment for you, or perhaps something that really is sobering to you that you think listeners must take advantage of as they listen?
Well, I'll go from one extreme to the other. The horrors of Biri was one. As we walked through that town, it's hard to believe what happened on October 7. But then on the other extreme, the inspiring stories we heard of hope and bravery and spiritual openness, they were truly encouraging to me, and I think they will be to those who listen to the program.
Yeah, it is an intense experience as you listen to our special Inside Israel, available at moodyradio.org/specials. Also, there are three bonus videos, including Charlie Dyer's look at the Hamas attack, comparing it to a biblical parallel event in history. That's all there at moodyradio.org/specials. As you listen, you will feel shock at what you see and hear through our on-the-ground reports. You will hear agony from family members of hostages. Yep, we talked to some of those. Hope, though, as Charlie points out, as you hear the wonderful impact that Christians are making, and we hope a resolve to pray for the peace of Jerusalem and the entire region. Again, our one-hour special is called Inside Israel, The War and What's Next. You'll find it at moodyradio.org/specials. Up next, we'll take you to a safe room in Israel. As the events of October 7 unfolded, you heard names like Ashkelon in the news, down toward the Gaza border. Welcome back to the Land in the Book, Segment 2. I'm John Gager, and you've joined us in Ashkelon. We're here on the balcony of a beautiful apartment. Tatiana Gurevich, you're an executive tour operator with Sarel Tours. You're in a beautiful neighborhood here.
Welcome to Ashkelon. It's a beautiful city on the Mediterranean, which you can see straight ahead. We live in the northern part of the city, so to your right, you can see the city of Ashdod that has been attacked many times during the war as well. We luckily live in the north of the city, so this part of the city was not so badly hit as the southern, which is closer to the Gaza Strip and the center of the city, where they have a lot of houses that are not properly equipped for the bad things that can happen during the war. We live in a very new neighborhood, and as you know well, decades ago, Israel has demanded that all the new construction must have a special security room with the reinforced walls and a special window. However, since the city, I guess it's surrounded by a very good protection, all the performance of the Iron Dome we could see very well from this balcony, because all that was happening right in front of us. Unfortunately, well, maybe fortunately, we did not spend much time on this lovely balcony with this view during the first weeks of the war, because it was quite dangerous. And we'll walk into the apartment so I can show you what was our daily routine during the first days and weeks of the war.
Before we head into the home, though, we're out here on the balcony. People are probably hearing the wind blowing into our microphone. Tell me about things that you have seen during the war and even as the war continues to wind down.
What was the most unusual, besides of the rocket attacks, to which unfortunately we are kind of used to living here in Ashkelon, but what did strike me during the first days and even weeks, it's the silence. It was a complete silence. The city was not isolated, but people, as I said, we didn't spend much time on the balcony because we were afraid to go out. And I guess that was the same thing with other people who live in the same neighborhood. Usually during the day, especially in the morning, you can hear children crying, parents hurrying them up to go to school, starting the engines, this and that, the sounds of a human life. The first days and weeks, you did not hear anything. It was absolutely silent. No cars, no people outside in the streets. More than that, you could not even hear the birds. Usually, I wake up with a bird singing here. No birds. So for me, it was very sad, because it was like you felt like you were in the middle of nowhere. You didn't see any people and you didn't hear any signs of human life around.
But from this balcony, you saw rockets.
Yes, we did. If you look to your left, there was a direct hit near one of the private houses down there. on the first day of war. Few days later, there was another house hit, one of the private houses. Besides, as I said, you could see all the rockets and the Iron Dome performance in front of our balcony. It was more picturesque, if I can use this word, during the night, because in the day you don't see much, but in the night, when the sky is black, you can see all the rockets going back and then Iron Dome hits them. Some apartment houses were also hit in our neighborhood. God saved us. Our building was not hit, but the building across the street on the other side was hit, and they are now doing some renovation works outside the building. The southern part of the city, which is closer to the Gaza Strip, and the center of the city were worse. And there were many houses destroyed by the rockets, and unfortunately, there were casualties, of course. And you can still see those houses as you drive through the city.
All right, let's go inside the home. We got to go to your safe room and feel what it's really like to be inside one of these. Passing through the living room, we're going to go down the hallway here. I see a black metal door here.
Listen to the sound. That's how it locks. And it should be locked. You should go there, lock the door, and stay inside minimum 10 minutes. Minimum. Here is the sound of unlocking the door.
Okay.
It's heavy.
Okay.
So this is the room where we spend almost all the time, the first weeks when the rocket attacks were very heavy during the time of sirens, which the first days were almost nonstop, almost nonstop. So this is a special protected room. I'm not an engineer, but what I know is that they use a special concrete for the walls so that they are stronger than other walls in the building, and a special window. So the window is made of a special glass, and then it also has special iron shutters, which are very heavy.
All right, let's hear it. Oh, it took the two of us to get that one. Let me see if we can get this one.
This one is easier.
Wow. They're thick, though. It's like an inch thick.
They are thick. They are very thick, and we had them shut for almost 3 months, I think. We did not even, as we closed them on the first days of the wars, I can't remember, October 7, 8, and then we kept them shut for 3 months minimum. This room protects you, of course. It does give you the feeling of being protected. However, as we know, the sound wave is very easy to feel and get. So we could hear everything that was going around. And there were several attacks. When I was sitting inside, locked, sealed here in this room, and when it was over, I was afraid to open the door and come out of this room, because from what I heard during the attack, it was almost a feeling like there is nothing outside this room. Honestly, I had a feeling if I opened the door, I don't see anything. So the sounds of the attacks were so heavy. So we were sitting and praying here are prayer cards in the security room. If you spend hours here, you can pray with this.
Lovely.
Yep.
That's
today's prayer. Let's read it. He shields all who take refuge in him. I don't have my reading glasses, John.
Psalm 18:30. He shields all who take refuge in him. What a fitting psalm is.
I did not put it on top. It was on top. You can see. I did not make it.
Let me ask you this, and take a seat here in your shelter. What is going on? Is your heart pitter-pattering 100 miles an hour when you finally have to jump up and get in here? I mean, what's going through your mind? Are you terrified? Are you in control? Are you...
Look, we've lived in Ashkelon for 6 years, I think. It's not the first time. So when it all started on October 7, and before we got to know other horrible things that happened, we thought it's too bad to use this word, but we thought it's just an ordinary rocket attack that we had experienced many times before. And I would say the rocket attacks for us, for the people in Ashkelon, I would not speak for other people, but for me personally, they were not as bad, although they were scary. It's the first time in years that I lived here in Ashkelon when I did get scared sitting in this room. But I think the worst thing was the news that we started to hear. My husband and I did not watch the news. We only watched the news that was telling us what we need to do, and that's it. And then a couple of days later, they started telling us what happened in the South. And that was when I was really hit by that war. That was the worst, worst feeling. Not the rockets, not the fear that I personally have sitting in the secured room. I mean, I could not complain because there were so many people which were in a much worse situation than me that I even felt that I don't have the right to complain. I mean, I have this room and I'm safe. How can I complain? There was even when we learned about the hostages, I remember for a couple of days, my mind would refuse to eat and shower. I could not do those simple things because every time I was thinking, oh, let's go and have a shower, I said, oh my gosh, there are so many people who cannot do that. And then my husband would say, let's sit and eat something at least. I said, how can I eat? I could not swallow the food, honestly. It passed. It passed because every pain comes down. And of course, we started doing daily things, showering, eating and everything. But I still remember those days when I could not do those simple things because I thought I have no right to do that when other people are suffering so badly. When the first fear came down and we all realized that it's not an ordinary attack, that is something more serious, what happened is that everyone wanted to help. Like, my husband and I cannot go to the army, but what can we do? There were so many people volunteering, cooking at home, taking the food to as close as they could to the soldiers, because it's not like you could drive anywhere you want, but taking the food down. There were many people who do not have the special room and they were afraid to leave their homes. So they were getting the phone numbers, the addresses of elderly people or handicapped people, delivering food to them. So these are two things that my husband and I did try to get involved in. But I think that even though that it was as little as we could do, it was a common. This I can say for the whole country, not only for myself. That's what everyone could say in the country, the feeling of unity, and everyone wanted to contribute something, to contribute into the protection of our country, as well as to show solidarity and to show that we are united. And when we are united, we are much stronger. There was an interesting thing that happened. A couple of weeks after the war started, there was, I think they call it flash mob, but it was like an emotional deed from all the people. All the people in the evening at 8 p.m. went out to their balconies and they all sang the national anthem, Hatikva. I think my husband's got it on his phone. He may find it and show it. Like, if we open the shutters again so that you can see it.
Grab yours, I'll grab mine.
You see, this one is closed too. But you see all those balconies? You can still see the Israeli flags. There were more of those during the first weeks. And all the people went out to their balconies and sang. It was so emotional. It was so touching. And yeah, it just helped us to know that you're not alone in your apartment, in your sealed room. There are other people around, even though you don't see and you don't hear them, but they are there and we are together.
Wow. So what do you think Americans don't really understand about this war? What did they not quite grasp?
I want not only Americans, but all people in the world not to know, but to realize and understand one, come to this understanding. We don't need wars. Wars are terrible for all. It doesn't matter if you're right. All people suffer from the war. I would want all people around the world, no matter which country they are in, to know that wars are terrible. And as much time and efforts we spend on climate crisis, I would spend, for example, for United Nations to educating people that in the 21st century, after all the history we had, we should not even think of starting any wars anywhere.
What else about this whole thing have I not asked you that's important to you? Anything? A story, a reflection, something you felt from God?
I felt a lot of support from the Americans. Kathy and Charlie were the first ones to send me a message asking, how am I? I received so many support and care from the people that I met on the tours to Israel. Many of those were with Charlie, Kathy. Some of them were with you, John, and many others. And that helped also. That helped knowing that you're not alone, knowing that there are brothers and sisters who will always support you. And praying. I mean, what can you do? If you're not in the army, if you cannot control things, the only thing you can do is to pray, because those prayers do materialize, and we do see it here in Israel.
God answers prayer.
He does.
Well, you've heard about the war. Now you've felt the war. You've heard about a safe room. We've taken you to one. And there's more to come on today's edition of The Land and the Book. We're about to head back into our studios where Charlie Dyer is waiting with his Bible. He's looking forward to it. I am too, as we tackle more of your questions next here on The Land and the Book. Segment 3 of The Land and the Book. I'm John Gager. Thanks for hanging out so far. I think you're going to love what's coming next. What's next? It's questions. Yours, perhaps. One of those that you have emailed us as you've puzzled over something you've encountered in Scripture. Maybe something you're wondering about prophecy. Maybe it's an issue related to the Middle East. Those questions are all fair game if you'll email us at thelandandthebook@moody.edu. Well, Charlie, Passover will soon be upon us, and one of the traditional Passover questions is, what makes this night different from all others? Passover is an important biblical holiday that has great meaning for both Jewish people and believers in Jesus, so I think that's an important question to ask.
It is, John, and that's why if someone has more questions and wants to know what makes Passover so special, well, our friends at Life and Messiah are offering to mail a free copy of their Messianic Passover Haggadah. The booklet will lead you through the celebration of Passover to see the rich connections to Jesus our Messiah and to the Last Supper. You'll also receive a link for an interactive Passover Seder video. With the Haggadah and video, you can celebrate Passover this year with your family and friends. Now to get this free offer, just go to lifeinmessiah.org and click on the Moody Radio button to find out more and to request your copy. That's lifeinmessiah.org.
All right, our question segment begins with a series of questions from a friend named Stan. He says, I'm witnessing to a couple of Jewish friends in my office, and something came up that I didn't have an answer for. In Isaiah 7:14, it talks about a virgin giving birth. And my friend pulled out a Bible or Torah, I'm not sure, and he read the Hebrew and said the actual Hebrew word or translation says, a young woman, not a virgin. Can you shed some light on this?
Yeah, and the Hebrew word used in Isaiah 7:14 is alma, which does indeed refer to a young woman of marriageable age. And your friend is right in that the Hebrew word for virgin is betula. However, I believe there's a rather easy answer to the objection he's raised. First, the word alma is used 8 other times in the Old Testament, and the woman or women it is describing there are presumed to be chaste, not sexually active. For example, in Genesis 24, it's used to describe Rebekah during her first encounter with Abraham's servant at the well. In Exodus 2, it's used to describe Moses' sister Miriam at the time Moses was found in the basket in the Nile. In Psalm 68:25, it's used to describe maidens playing tambourines in the procession to God's sanctuary. In Proverbs 30, one of my favorites, the writer speaks of the 4 mysterious ways, with the 4th being the way of a man with a maid. And that's the word there. But it's picturing the mystery of love and courtship. There's nothing sexual or immoral in that verse. In Song of Solomon 6:8, the word's used to describe one of the three groups of females in Solomon's household. It says, there are 60 queens, 80 concubines, and maidens without number. Here it's referring to the female attendants who took care of the women in the harem. But these maidens are quite distinct from those who are connected sexually to the king. Now, my point is that every time the word Alma is used, it's used to describe a young woman with a focus on her age. We might use the word teenager in a similar way, but even that's not a good comparison. And the next point is that young woman of marriageable age was presumed to be, in fact, was expected to be chaste. In Deuteronomy 22, it describes a number of issues related to marriage and sexual immorality. And one key underlying issue is that sexual purity prior to marriage was extremely important, so much so that the death penalty was imposed on a young woman who wasn't chaste. In fact, it says in verse 21 there, she's done a disgraceful thing in Israel by being promiscuous while still in her father's house. So an Alma, a young woman of marriageable age, was presumed to be a Betula, a virgin. So I put all this together and look at one last thing. The Septuagint, the Greek translation of Isaiah 7:14, was made about 100 years before the time of Jesus. They were trying to translate Isaiah 7:14 into Greek, and they translated Alma as Parthenos, the Greek word for virgin, rather than using the normal Greek word for maiden, which was chore. In other words, they felt the Greek word for maiden had too much baggage attached to it in the loose moral climate of Greece. So they used a word that conveyed the chastity that came with a young woman of marriageable age in the Hebrew culture.
Stan goes on, I shared with my Jewish friend Micah 5 verse 2, that verse pointing to the Messiah being born in Bethlehem, and his Old Testament scripture did not have a Micah 5 verse 1. He started with Micah 5 verse 2 as the first verse in Micah. Just curious, your thoughts about this.
Yeah, don't get rattled by your friend's Hebrew Bible not matching your Bible right at that point. It has all the verses, but the chapter and verse divisions in that spot are just slightly different between the Hebrew and English Bibles. What we have as Micah 5:1 in our Bibles is actually Micah 4, verse 14 in their Bibles. The chapter and verse divisions were added later in history, and they don't impact the meaning of what Micah was saying. So in this case, it's all there, just the verse divisions are slightly different. And that's what I think you can share with your friend.
Are there other Old Testament scriptures like Isaiah 53 that would be appropriate to show my Jewish friend that Jesus is the Messiah and is also coming again a second time? They think the Messiah only comes once and believe, of course, Jesus was not the Messiah, and so they're still waiting. What do you think?
Yeah, well, in terms of showing the two comings of the Messiah, I think the problem is that the Old Testament does seem confusing and was so at the time of Christ. Two examples. In 1 Peter 1, 10 and 11, Peter writes, concerning this salvation, the prophets who spoke of the grace that was to come to you searched intently with the greatest care, trying to find out the time and circumstances to which the Spirit of Christ in them was pointing when he predicted the sufferings of Christ, there's the first coming, and the glories that would follow, that's the second coming. Peter's saying that the prophets who delivered the prophecies were themselves scratching their heads, trying to put the material together. They didn't quite have it all together there. Now, having said that, here's my suggestion on how to address the issue with your friend. Point out the two sets of Old Testament prophecies related to the Messiah. So Isaiah 53 pictures a suffering servant coming to bear our sin. And Zechariah 9 and 11 describe the Messiah riding into Jerusalem on a colt, but being rejected and sold for 30 pieces of silver. Then point out the passages that picture a coming triumphant Messiah. Isaiah 9 verses 6 to 7, this child's going to sit on David's throne. And Micah 5, 2, which talks about him ruling. Then ask, how can the Messiah come to reign, but also come to suffer, be rejected, and die for our sins? And before he answers, point out two other passages. Daniel 9, 24 to 27, which gives the time from the going forth of a command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the Messiah, the prince. But then says the anointed one, the Messiah, is going to be cut off. And the word there carries the idea of being put to death. And then the second passage to read, Zechariah 12, 10. It describes God's return to his people and says, they'll look on me, the one they've pierced, and mourn as one mourns for an only child. And here's the conundrum for him. How can the Messiah be born as a child, though his goings forth are from of ancient times, but be rejected, cut off, killed, only to return again and people realize he's the one they pierced? And then explain, it's not two different messiahs, it's two different comings, which is what Peter was saying in that 1 Peter 1 passage.
If you're just joining us, this is The Land and the Book from Moody Radio. Our host is Charlie Dyer, a pastor, an author, conference speaker, a guy who's been to Israel more than 100 times. I'm John Gager, tagging along, enjoying all of your questions. like this one from Nancy. She says, as I read about the offering system God ordered for Israel, it would seem that a huge amount of wood would be required for all of the burning. Was there a time when the country had large amounts of trees covering the land? On my tour of Israel, I saw a nation largely barren of trees. And by the way, whose job was it to bring in the wood to the site of the offerings?
Now, there definitely was more forested land in Israel in the past. And there's one passage I think that can help us with this. It's Joshua 17. That's when they're assigning the land to the different tribes. And Joshua answers a complaint from the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. They felt they hadn't gotten enough land. Well, when you look at a map showing the land that they had received, it's actually quite large. But in answer to their complaint, Joshua says, "You're numerous and very powerful. You will have not one allowance, but the forested hill country as well." There it is, the forested hill country. "Clear it, and its farthest limits will be yours." So evidently, the mountainous area in the center of the country was sparsely inhabited and covered in forests. In terms of whose job it was to bring in the wood, well, in Joshua chapter 9, verse 27, when Joshua made the deal with the Gibeonites, who tricked Israel into making a peace treaty, he required them to be woodcutters and water carriers for the community and for the altar of the Lord at the place the Lord would choose. So it was the Gibeonites' job to gather all that wood for the altar.
I like this question. Fascinating. Do we know how many years the tabernacle was actually used? It seems like a miracle of God that the fabric curtains didn't wear out during all those years of putting up and taking down.
Yeah, you know, all of our clothes seem to wear out fast. So how did all that fabric for the tabernacle not wear out? Well, the tabernacle was built and placed in operation about a year after the Exodus, so it should be around 1444 BC. We know it was set up in Shiloh and functioned there till the coming of Samuel. And Samuel was born around 1070 BC, so the tabernacle was around for at least 375 years. Jewish tradition says the tabernacle was at Shiloh for 369, and then add the time in the wilderness. It's probably a function for around 400 years. So how could the fabric last that long? Well, it's possible some parts of the fabric did wear out and needed to be replaced. But we also know when it was at Shiloh, a more permanent structure was built. And I say that because in 1 Samuel 3:15, we're told Samuel opened the doors of the house of the Lord. It suggests that the tent housing that the holy place, the Holy of Holies, had been replaced with a structure that had an entry door rather than a tent flap. Now, the tent might have still been draped over the top, we just don't know, but there appears to be a more permanent building by the time of Samuel, and that suggests to me that all the other materials might have been replaced as they were worn out.
Well, you guys have certainly taken us all over the biblical map today with your questions, and we're grateful for it. We love this time and love chatting with you, love answering your questions. Yours is welcome with a quick email to thelandandthebook@moody.edu. Charlie will read your question personally, answer it personally, send you back an email, and then you'll be in the queue for a future broadcast. It's another great devotional from our host, Charlie Dyer, next, right here. Well, it's everybody's favorite time of year. Yeah, this week brings us tax day. Are you pumped? Are you excited? Are you ready? John Gager here. Pardon the foolishness. Charlie, I'm sure you had your stuff done weeks ago. Is that right?
I did, John. That's one of those, it's a game for me. It's therapy, if you will, to get it all done and all in order and sent in.
All of which is sort of a rather circuitous route to today's devotional topic. I love your title, A Fishy Tax Story. Where are we going in the scriptures?
Well, we're heading to Matthew chapter 17.
All right, it'll be a lot more pleasant, I guarantee, than whatever you've got to do with taxes this week. We'll get to that devotional after this Holy Land Experience testimony.
Let me just say that as a follower of Jesus Christ, we are commanded to love what he loves. And there is no doubt from studying the Bible that God in Jesus Christ love this land, love the people in this land. And before I came here, of course, you know, we wanted to come here because we wanted to see what God loved. But now we've seen the land, we've seen the people, we've seen so much that it is going to be now, of course, we'll continue to love Israel, but we'll do it in just a real way. And I'm looking forward to coming back. I don't know when that might happen or how that might happen, but I just know, of course, eventually we'll all be here forever. That's true. But before then, if the Lord tarries, I'm just looking forward to the next trip.
All right. Thank you so much. Charlie, I'm looking forward to your devotional in Matthew 17. Take it away.
Well, thanks, John. And as John mentioned, this coming week is tax day. It's that wonderful time of the year when millions of tax returns have to be filled out and mailed off to the Internal Revenue Service in the modern version of render unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's. And to help put us in the proper mood for our civic, legal, and patriotic duty, we're traveling to Capernaum on the northwestern shore of the Sea of Galilee. One of Jesus' 12 disciples had originally been a tax collector in Capernaum. Think of Matthew as the first century equivalent of an IRS agent. But by the time of our story, he had retired from government work to become a full-time follower of Jesus. In fact, the change was rather dramatic. Having just healed a paralytic at Peter's house, Matthew himself records what happened next. Jesus saw a man named Matthew sitting at the tax collector's booth. "Follow me," he told him, and Matthew got up and followed him. Without so much as even a two-week notice, Matthew went from the IRS to the IHS in his service. But now in Matthew 17, following a time of extensive ministry, we again find Jesus and the disciples back in Capernaum. And that's where this fishy tax story begins. But this time we encounter a different taxing authority. Much like someone today paying federal, state, and sometimes even local taxes, so in Jesus' day, there were multiple taxing authorities. The Roman government was the most prominent and most despised. But the religious authorities also collected a tax for the upkeep of the temple and its functioning. And it's that taxing body that surprises Peter with a rather direct question. Matthew sets the scene this way. After Jesus and his disciples arrived in Capernaum, the collectors of the 2 drachma tax came to Peter and asked, "Doesn't your teacher pay the temple tax?" Caught somewhat off guard by the question, Peter didn't hesitate to respond. "Yes, he does," he replied. Now, Peter hadn't actually seen Jesus pay the tax, but he never hesitated in giving an authoritative answer, even if that answer might be wrong. When Peter finally made it back to the house where Jesus was staying, Jesus surprised him with an unusual question. "What do you think, Simon?" he asked. "From whom do the kings of the earth collect duty and taxes? From their own sons or from others?" Peter might not have understood why Jesus was asking such an unusual question, but once again he was quick to provide an answer. "Well, from others." Jesus then explained the significance of the answer. The sons of the king are exempt from paying taxes, and since the temple was God's house, God's son was also not required to pay the tax. But Jesus followed his mild rebuke with a practical suggestion. "But so that we may not offend them, go to the lake and throw out your line. Take the first fish you catch, open its mouth, and you will find a 4 drachma coin. Take it and give it to them for my tax and yours." End of story, or so it seems to us. But there's something fishy about that answer. Peter was a fisherman, and most of the time fishermen around the Sea of Galilee used nets rather than a hook and a line. So is this some sort of practical joke on Jesus' part? It's not. But there is a joke from this story played out on most Christians who visit Israel and have a St. Peter's fish lunch somewhere around the lake. It's a joke because the fish they eat wasn't the type caught by Peter. How do I know that? Well, it's not because of my love of fish or fishing, which, if you've listened to this program for any length of time, you already know. No, for this bit of truth, I defer to Mendel Noon, a Jewish kibbutznik who fished the Sea of Galilee for many years. Here's his insight. It's because of this miracle that the musht, that's the Hebrew name of the fish that's today called St. Peter's fish, was given. However, from the realistic point of view, and in contradiction to all accepted tradition, it cannot have been the fish caught by Peter with a hook and line in this famous miracle. The reason is simple. The musht feeds on plankton and is not attracted by other food. It's therefore caught with nets, not with hook and line. The fishermen on the lake have, since time immemorial, used hook and line with sardine as bait to fish for barbels, which are predators and bottom feeders. So the St. Peter musht, or tilapia, being served at the Sea of Galilee likely isn't the fish Peter caught with a hook and line. But back to our fishy story. Peter threw in his line along the water's edge, wondering what would happen next. But he shouldn't have been surprised because Jesus told him exactly what would happen. He caught this bottom feeder, and as he opened its mouth to retrieve the hook, there, lodged inside, was a 4 drachma coin. In Greek, it says he found a small stetar, which was equivalent to 4 drachmas. The story actually ends before Peter carries out Jesus' command, so some believe Peter didn't actually catch a fish or pay the tax. But if that's the case, why did Matthew include the story at all? I think it's better to simply assume Peter did as Jesus commanded, caught the fish, found the coin, and paid the tax. And by the way, a drachma was the equivalent of a denarius or a day's wages. The annual temple tax was the equivalent of 2 days' wages, and the coin inside the fish's mouth paid that tax for both Peter and Jesus. But as we stand here on the shore of the Sea of Galilee in Capernaum, we need to ask ourselves an even bigger question. Why did Matthew include this story? Certainly his background as a tax collector might be part of the reason, but within this section of his gospel, Matthew focuses on Peter and Jesus 5 times. In chapter 14, he mentions that it was Peter who tried to walk on the water to Jesus. In chapter 15, it's Peter who asked Jesus to explain the parable to them. In chapter 16, Jesus blesses Peter for understanding who he was, and then turns around and chastises Peter for denying Jesus' prediction of his coming death. And then here in chapter 17, Jesus explains to Peter why he didn't have to pay the temple tax because of his authority as God's son. Whether or not Peter understood it at the time, Jesus was discipling him in a special way to help Peter master the lessons of living a godly life in a hostile world. So did Peter master those lessons? I think the answer can be found in 1 Peter 2. There Peter wrote, "Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every authority instituted among men, whether to the king as the supreme authority or to governors who are sent by him to punish those who do wrong and to commend those who do right. For it is God's will that by doing good you should silence the ignorant talk of foolish men. Live as free men, but do not use your freedom as a cover-up for evil. Live as servants of God. Show proper respect to everyone. Love the brotherhood of believers. Fear God. Honor the king." And that brings us back to tax day and the IRS. What does God want from his followers today? He wants us to submit to civil authority and to do what's right in God's eyes, or as Peter says, fear God and honor the king. So finish up those forms and get them mailed or sent electronically by the deadline. And then thank God for being able to do good and not use your freedom as a cover-up for evil. Oh yeah, and when you're done, stop by your nearest fish joint for a fish sandwich, or if you're like me, head out for a St. Peter's pizza, or maybe even a St. Peter's grilled chicken sandwich.
They all sound good to me, Charlie. Hey, if you've never checked out our podcast, it's waiting for you now at our website, thelandandthebook.org, and you can share that podcast with your friends, folks who don't live anywhere near a radio station that carries our program. So let them know about the Land and the Book podcast, and again, you'll find it at thelandandthebook.org. What you won't find right now is more time. It's gone. But we'll be back, Lord willing, next week at this same time for another edition of The Land and the Book, a production of Moody Radio, a ministry of Moody Bible Institute.